He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm kind of bummed out today, actually.
Well, for this reason, with this tweet, thank you, Boston. Good night and good luck. Nearly 50 years of a unique brand of alternative, edgy journalism in Boston came to an end. The Boston Phoenix is soon to be no more. Joining us in Studio 3 is Adam Riley, a Phoenix alum now at GBH, and the longtime excellent editor of the Boston Phoenix is joining us on the phone. That, of course, would be Peter Kadzis. Hello, Peter, and hello, Adam.
I have to correct you, Jim. What? I'm executive editor.
Oh, excuse me, Peter Kadzis. A little testy today.
And I'll add soon to be unemployed.
Oh, jeez. Well, what a start.
Peter, what happened? I mean, we all thought a few months ago with your new change into a glossier publication, it was looking great. We thought this was everybody's stunned.
Listen, it was looking great. Readers loved it. Local advertisers loved it. The problem is national advertisers were not enticed. We have, since 9/11, we've lost most of our national advertising. We hoped that turning into a magazine would bring it back. It didn't. This is a story about the economy and advertising, not about journalism.
And Peter, did you have a sense, you and Steve Mindich, obviously your boss, owner of the paper, did you have a sense when you did convert 6 months ago that this thing was hanging by a thread and that you may be sending a tweet like you did yesterday?
No. First of all, Steven's by nature a Buccaneer, and Buccaneers are by nature optimistic. I was optimistic as well. I thought this was a really smart thing to do. But in a way, Stephen and I and Carly Carioli, the editor who executed this, we're in the same boat that everyone in print journalism is. We're engaged in an existential struggle for survival. And you can't sit back and do nothing. You have to do something. There were no negative consequences of our something. There just weren't any positive ones.
And that's one of the reasons why one of your former print employees is now in broadcast journalism. Adam Riley is in the studio. When you first heard this thing, Adam, what'd you feel? What was it like?
It was very sad. I mean, I worked at the Phoenix.
How many years were you there?
As my editor, I think the whole time, for almost seven years, from 2003 until 2010, when I came over here. And it got even sadder when I went over to interview Peter yesterday for Greater Boston. We're talking about the Phoenix's closure today on Beat the Press. And it was pretty gut-wrenching. I mean, it was like walking into a wake. And I think that, like a lot of other people who work there, I came there not really knowing a whole heck of a lot about how journalism worked. I'd had some jobs before, but not jobs that gave me the exposure or the freedom that the Phoenix did. And it's thinking back on it now, I mean, it's almost, I think I remember my time at the Phoenix the way that other people probably remember college or something like that. It's like, you know,
What's a blur for 7 years?
No,
is that what you
no,
mean?
No, no. as an experience that occurs in the workplace but transcends work. I mean, the relationships, I think the interpersonal relationships that people forge there tended to be extremely strong. And I think a lot of us were there at kind of pivotal periods in our lives, you know, whether it was our 20s or 30s, in a stretch where we sort of went from being kids to becoming actual adults and actual professional journalists. And I think that you put those two things together, and I think they actually reinforce each other, by the way, and it just makes for a really heady heady time, which, you know, is kind of impossible to replicate. I knew when I came to WGBH and I made the move of my own volition for a couple reasons, but I knew that there were things that I had experienced at the Phoenix that I would never again experience in my journalistic life. And that's very much the case.
That's the voice of Adam Riley, former reporter at the Boston Phoenix, and now he's at WGBH-TV. And obviously we're talking to Peter Kadzis, the executive editor of the Boston Phoenix. Our number, by the way, if you want to call about memories of coverage or a particular reporter, you can give us a buzz at 877-301-8970.
Peter Kadzis, the Boston Phoenix produced a wealth of hugely talented writers, name some of them for people that don't know. I mean, Susan Orlean, she's quoted in the Globe story today as a great writer at The New Yorker. Who else?
Janet Maslin at The New
York Times.
Movie critic?
At The New York Times. Mark Leibovich of The New York Times. Mike Crowley of Time Magazine. Jason Gay of The Wall Street Journal. David Denby, the film critic. Listen, at one point, every single major news critic in New York City was a Phoenix alum.
And you won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism.
George Schwartz, our classical music writer. Leave it to the Phoenix, the rock and roll newspaper, to win a Pulitzer for classical music coverage.
And also,
that was because of Lloyd Schwartz.
And also the late, great Caroline Knapp, who wrote a column for you for a year. What was it called? What was her column called?
Alice Kay.
Yeah. It was a great column about dating and romance, and she wrote great.
And every column began, Alice Kay awoke in bed.
Hey, Peter Kansas.
I don't know how many people know this, but.
Peter, you've worked at other places. Obviously, you've had a long reign there at the Phoenix.
25 years. Yeah.
When you're inside a place like that, I think Adam described it beautifully a couple of minutes ago. What's the feel? What's the different feel inside the Boston Phoenix newsroom as compared to other places you've worked? Why is it special?
The Phoenix is an incredibly loving and incredibly dysfunctional family where every person next to you is even more eccentric than the one down the line. I have never worked at a place where people develop such close bonds. You know, there is something very much like the college experience, or listen, I've worked at a number of big places, Time Inc., Forbes, the New York Daily News. Those other places all have their quirks and all have their sort of beautiful things. But what the Phoenix has that I personally have never encountered anywhere else is a total sense of group mission. Now, the mission is usually pretty subversive, but everyone buys into it. And by the way, that includes, you know, the men and women in the sales department, you know, our receptionist. The whole place is a little kooky.
You know, Peter, I think it was in the Globe story, I'm not sure, but you'll correct me as well. Obviously, you're continuing your operation, the Phoenix, in both Providence and Portland, Maine, and people should know that. A point was made by someone that alternative weeklies like yours in major markets are having a really tough time. Is that the case across the country, or is this an aberrational
kind? It is the case across
the
country.
Why is that?
Look,
why?
Part of it is there are two answers to that. The business answer is because the internet has, as the experts say, you know, the internet has destroyed and reordered the advertising market, and everything's up for grabs, and so that makes it harder for everyone, not just alternatives, but even the New York Times to get ads. The second has to do with editorial quality, and I'll get back to the Phoenix in a second. But with the rise of the internet and so many voices available everywhere else, people can get quirky, good voices a lot of places. What's happened at, say, the Village Voice is they've responded to the bad economic conditions by cutting their staff in lowering standards. We decided not to do that. Look, we made cuts, we made trims, but there was a point beyond which we weren't going to go. And instead, we decided to all go down with the ship.
I don't want to bog us down in the sort of long list of distinguished
Phoenix
alums,
of which I
am not one. But it's kind of humbling to talk about these gargantuan names that came out of there. But, you know, you always forget someone when you're running through this. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but Peter Kanellis, the Globe's op-ed page editor.
Scott Lehigh at the Globe.
I think Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker.
Jeffrey Toobin.
Did some with Seth Mnookin. A bunch of other people at the Globe. Yvonne Abraham, Michael Resendiz. James Parker, who I worked with, is a terrific guy who now writes about film and TV for The Atlantic. I mean, it's just the list
goes on. And Dan Kennedy.
Joe Klein.
Joe Klein, who wrote Primary Colors. You know,
Peter Gorelick, the great music biographer. I mean, it's a staggering alumni association.
How you feel? You know, we haven't asked you this. How miserable are you today? I mean, not only is this happening to your baby, you're in Steve Mindich's and your colleague's baby. You've been doing this for an awful long time. How are you feeling this morning?
Well, I'm a little numb, but I got to tell you, I mean, I think it'll hit me later. I just sent an email to someone saying that, geez, closing this place down is even harder work than it was keeping it afloat. But it'll hit me. I got to tell you, when I wake up in the morning, I'm really sad.
Yeah.
The good thing about coming to the office is all this stuff to do. You know, yes, it's closing out, and yes, it's giving interviews like this, and, you know, starting Monday, it's making sure Portland and Providence are on solid footing, because I'm going to be leaving here in about 2 weeks.
You maybe. Are?
Oh, yeah, I'm toast, too.
I didn't know you were toast.
I mean, I'm going down with the ship. I mean, I guess I'm in a life raft at the moment. But listen.
Peter, I want to get back to you what I said. You said a minute ago, but you decided not to go the way of the Village Voice, dramatic staff cutting, and I don't know what you said, lowering standards. Forget the lowering standards for a second. Could you have done, you and Mindich have done something on the reduction of staff, maybe narrowing of the mission to keep a different kind of Boston Phoenix life, one that didn't violate whatever principles you both share. But could you have done that?
No, we could have trimmed it. We could have trimmed it, dumbed it down, made it more innocuous, and probably kept it afloat. But we also would have sort of ruined the lives of a lot of people in the course of doing it.
And disappointed your readers who went to you for, you know, a great...
Listen, do I have time for a quick story? This is a real story.
You absolutely do.
I'm walking down the street this morning, and a guy I don't know drives by with his window rolled down, and he hollers to me, "Hey, Peter." I assume he recognized me, Jim, from being on your show.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate that.
You're very recognizable, Peter.
And he says, "Hey, Peter, where am I going to read Bernstein now?"
Yeah,
David Bernstein.
I am overwhelmed with the emails, the phone calls, the social media reaction. I mean, I knew there'd be a reaction. I had no idea that we had such an emotional bond with our readers. And because we're online, like everyone else, the reaction comes from all across the country.
Hey, Peter, since you were kind enough to mention your appearances on my television show, since you have those beautiful round glasses, do you mind sharing with our listeners what you told me last time you had a friend call you and say what you looked like on my particular show? What was that?
Right after I got off Broadside, I had a friend call me up and said, "Geez, you sounded great, but you look like Gertrude Stein with a beard." That was said by the very distinguished historian Douglas Shantucci, and it is one of my favorite self-put-downs.
Just to linger on the subject of David Bernstein for a little bit. I worked with David
great
the entire time
writer.
I was there.
Great.
And he and you know I'm biased because we're former colleagues and are friendly, but I think David is really I think he's the best person covering politics in Massachusetts right now. Others will suggest other names, but I think David's fantastic. And I don't know. I didn't want him to leave the Phoenix, but he has done so much good work over the last few years that I have no idea why Politico or, MSNBC or some national outlet, the New Republic, I don't know why he hasn't been picked up. I mean, David was the one who established back in 2008 that this tale of Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, marching with Martin Luther King, that Mitt Romney loved to recount on the campaign trail, was just bogus. And it's something, if David hadn't sort of peeled back the layers on this, this myth would have been accepted as reality forever. And David blew it out of the water. And he's done so much other good stuff. I hope everyone from the Phoenix lands on their feet quickly, but David should be snapped up immediately.
By the way, that's the voice of Adam Riley, an alum of the Boston Phoenix, now at WGBH. And on the phone with us, of course, is Peter Kadzis, the executive editor now for 25 years.
Peter, another great story. Your boss, Stephen Mindich, who, of course, owns the Phoenix, or did own the Phoenix, or I guess he still owns it. But in any case, he was willing to stick his neck out in some very controversial situations. Tell people, if they don't know it, the story about Daniel Pearl.
Okay, well, what happened is, people may remember Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal a journalist who was kidnapped in the Middle East and held by terrorists and was decapitated. What happened is there was rumors that there was an internet video. And here's how the story broke down. Dan Kennedy happened to find it online. He sent me a link that just said, look at this. This is grisly. And I didn't. It was really grisly. And I sent it to Stephen, and I said, what do you think? You know, wondering what he'd say, and I knew what he was going to say. He said, geez, do you think we should post this? And I said, absolutely. But let me tell you, this is how innocent we all were. The internet was relatively new. We put it up, and it was grisly. And we didn't post it. We put a link with all sorts of warnings.
Yep.
Saying, this is grisly, this is that. And we explained that we thought it was important that people who wanted to see could see what the real face of terror was. And the internet exploded. We had so much traffic that our site continually crashed. We got death threats, bomb threats, people pleading with us to take it down.
Scoldings in the mainstream media, right? Wall Street Journal, Mark Bowden.
The media ethicists lecturing us. Now, of course, when I said to them, what is different about this and Life magazine printing pictures of concentration camps?
Right.
They really didn't have something to say. By the way, I remember Mark Jerkowitz, who worked for us, but he was at the Globe as a media critic. I said, Mark, I'm just astounded by this. And off the record, he says, what, are you crazy? I said, Mark, I'm just naive. I honestly believed we had a public responsibility to do this.
I think you did. I think it was an extremely courageous move on the Boston Phoenix part.
Stephen stood behind us. Stephen championed it. And it was a very proud moment. But I got to say, another thing we're proud of is, you know, a good year before the Globe's excellent groundbreaking series on sexual abuse by the Catholic Church, Kristen Lombardi, directed by news editor Susan Ryan Vollmar, did an astounding series of articles that brought to the public's attention just how widespread this problem was. And this in no way takes away from the work the Globe did. But a year earlier, we pointed out the horrible story that was out there. I mean, those are two during my years here, probably two of our greatest moments.
Hey, Adam, you report on, that's Peter Kadzis, the executive editor of the Boston Phoenix for a quarter of a century. Adam Riley, former reporter at the Boston Phoenix, now at WGBH-TV, is with us. Adam, you're in a better position than Peter is to answer this, I think, is what fills this hole, if anything? And I know the answer is there probably isn't anything. What comes close to filling this edgy, risk-taking hole in journalism in and around Boston?
Well, the trick is going to be finding, if anything were to attempt to fill the hole, they would need to both be as sort of brave as the Phoenix was editorially, but also be able to pay the way the Phoenix did. And I think that's the big, I don't know that entity, whatever it would be or however it might look, exists, because it's very easy to imagine, you know, former Phoenix staffers saying, you know, we don't want to let this thing die. We're going to put up a site. We're going to write as a labor of love. But that's the sort of thing that I think becomes harder and harder to do as you get older. Maybe I'm over-personalizing here. It's hard to sustain long-term. So a new entity would have to figure out how to do comparable editorial work while monetizing it more effectively than the Phoenix, with all its institutional expertise, was able to do. So I don't really know. I mean, you know, the Weekly Dig is the alt-weekly that is still out there that love to take shots at us when I was at the Phoenix. And over the years, they've had some, you know, talented people pass through there. Chris Ferrone, who does really good stuff for the Phoenix now.
Did all the great Occupy reporting.
Is a Weekly Dig alum. And a few people have followed that path. But I don't think that, you know, the Dig is not going to step in and fill the Phoenix's shoes. I would humbly propose. So I'm not sure. I don't know that the niche gets filled. My guess is it gets filled with existing publications or media outlets trying to maybe branch out in the direction of the stuff that Phoenix used to do, whether it's more sort of, you know, music coverage directed at the young, or someone picking up, you know, the media criticism beat, which used to be so essential at the Phoenix. But I don't think any new being will, you know, come into being to replace it.
Do you think, do you, Peter Kadzis?
I don't. I mean, I don't feel awkward about answering any questions. This one, I'm a little cautious about, but I, at the moment, don't see anything. That doesn't mean that something that nobody or that I haven't imagined won't come up. I mean, I could imagine, and I'm quite serious about this, an outfit like WGBH becoming more aggressive online with certain sorts of stories. But to get the sort of mix that the Phoenix had with, you know, investigation, hard-hitting, serious, insightful politics in the arts, it's a tough thing to balance.
You know,
I'm sorry.
Just to jump in briefly, I mean, I'm looking across the desk at the globe, which Marjorie has splayed out in front of her, and the cover in the middle is this piece that Peter allowed me to do, and in retrospect, I recognize what an insane luxury it was. I went and saw this guy, Tom Monahan, who was the founder of Domino's, give a speech at Boston College High School, in which Monahan talked about how he was building a Catholic utopia in Florida.
I remember this, actually.
Where there would be no
this.
Contraception sold in the stores and no pornography carried on the cable channels, and I went back and told Peter that I'd heard about this really fascinating thing, and I was able to go down to Florida. You know, I crashed with my in-laws, but I was flown down by the Phoenix and covered the story that the national media hadn't paid attention to. And to be able to, yeah, that's the
what
Christ
is
the by the slice.
Christ by the slice.
Oh, the artwork was terrific.
Oh, I got to mind you. I was just going to say, you know why I let them do it?
Why?
Because I figured out a headline before it went down there.
It's a great headline, Peter. And, you know, you get a great editorial today, too. And this is another example of the out-of-the-box thinking by the Boston Phoenix, suggesting that Barack Obama, who's pardoned almost nobody and commuted almost nobody's sentence, get with the program, commute the sentence of Sal DeMasi. It doesn't mean he gets a pardon. It means he gets out of jail because he seems to be dying. He's, of course, the former Speaker of the House.
What's your life? He got a sentence. Last line in your editorial is he got a sentence of, what, 8 years? He didn't get a death sentence?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Editorial.
It was a great one.
Just a point I want to make that you reminded me of when you brought up that editorial. I saw some, you know, chatter from, I think it was an anonymous satirical Twitter account yesterday, kind of kicking the Phoenix as it was dying, complaining that it was a predictable liberal partisan publication. And I just, you know, I think that misconception is out there on the part of many people, and it's totally a misconception. I mean, there was a piece that David Bernstein did several years back, which was called Peter, you can remind me if I'm getting this wrong, but was it DeMasi's Sheep? Is that what it was called? Casting the members of the state legislature.
By the
legislature
way, one of my favorite pundits was quoted in that particular piece.
Which
That'd
pundit?
Be me.
Oh, nice.
You, Adam. But go ahead, Adam.
No, it was a terrific piece, just talking about how the Democratic members of the legislature marched
great
in lockstep
point.
With
story.
The Democratic Speaker of the House, Sal DeMasi. So to paint the paper as, I mean, there was a generally liberal editorial slant. But I don't think, it wasn't predictably liberal.
Another editorial I'm proud of is when his Romney-ness was running Billy Bulger out of UMass, I wrote an editorial that said, you know, don't worry, the sky is not falling. We disagreed with almost nothing when Bulger was Senate president, but he has been a great president of UMass, and he should be kept there. So we are much more unpredictable than people give us credit.
Hey, Peter, final thing for me. I didn't know you were losing your job in a couple of weeks. But I mentioned when I introduced you when you were in the studio a couple of weeks ago that you used to live on Marjorie's third floor.
Yes, he did.
On her behalf, she told me that she was willing to offer one of her bedrooms to you and your family.
That's right.
So if that's necessary, you have her cell phone number, do you not, Peter?
I do.
Peter Kadzis, you've done great work. All of your colleagues and current staff and former staff have done great work. You have a lot to be proud of, and we're all in mourning. I should say the newsroom upstairs, Adam can say to this,
besides,
was shocked yesterday.
It's true.
Sick to their stomachs.
We wish you
this.
A lot of luck. Send our best to everybody, Peter, and good luck to you personally as well. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Just have me back.
We will.
Absolutely.
Peter Kadzis, executive editor of the Boston Phoenix.
Thank you very much for being with us again, Peter, and thank you very much, WGBH's Adam Riley.
Thanks
for
having me down
here,
guys.
Talk with us. Okay.
You're talking about this tonight on Beat the Press, he says. Is that correct?
We are. We're doing a segment in which Peter will be featured.
Oh, great. Terrific.
So, to drink or not to drink publicly, that is the question. Should public imbibing be allowed at St. Patrick's Day Parade? We'll debate it next on 89.7 WGBH.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. These next few minutes are part of a larger debate about whether Boston is stuck in the past in some ways or moving into the future. It's sort of part of the debate going on between people like Greg Selko, the guy who's head of Karmaloop and head of the Future Boston Alliance. It's a group that's trying to make Boston a little friendlier to its younger residents. And the mayor, who we don't know if he's running for re-election, but I have to say I'm a fan on most counts of Mayor Menino. The question relates to this Sunday, and Marjorie posed it, I think, too narrowly a couple of seconds ago. There's a debate every couple of years with the South, with the St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston, which obviously is a fairly unique, if that's not improper grammar, Marjorie.
It is, Jim, I know it is,
but you'll understand where I'm going. Boston institution, obviously other cities do it as well, but it really is Boston. So there's a question as to whether or not to make the day as fun as I think it can be and should be, should people be allowed to drink in public places? And by the way, I don't just mean on the route of the St. Patrick's Day Parade. There are lots of St. Patrick's celebrations throughout the city. Obviously, they have to be policed. We're not urging horrible public drunkenness or anything. But to make the day a more sort of user-friendly kind of thing, and to make the city a more user-friendly kind of city, wouldn't it be great if just for one day, in limited geographical parts of the city, on Sunday, if you and your friends were able to have a drink outside? Mm-hmm. On a number of occasions, Tom Menino was on our former radio show, on my television show. I'm a big advocate of this. In my hometown of Philadelphia, there's certain parts of Philadelphia during the summer, I think in July and August, we're in maybe a 6 or 7 square block radius. When the weather is pretty warm, people can walk around with a drink outside. I love it. Looking at Marjorie, I get a sense she doesn't. Our number is 877-301-8970. And so we want to know, should public drinking, not public drunkenness, public drinking be allowed on St. Patrick's Day at the parade and throughout the city?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, Jim, if you've been to the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Well, actually, I don't know. You know, I'm the television host of the St. Patrick's Day breakfast, and
yeah.
NECN also
carries
the parade.
Okay.
Well, I've seen it.
Were you to go to the St. Patrick's Day parade, you might see it's pretty raucous already. This is a town full of college kids. What more fun can there be than coming over to South Boston on St. Patrick's Day and getting absolutely blottoed on the streets of
West
Broadway?
Well, with all
due
respect, you're wrong. If you listen to the police commissioners, and I assume we'll hear
from
Commissioner Davis probably Friday or Saturday, mm-hmm. And maybe the mayor, there's often a zero tolerance policy on drinking outside. And again, you know, for those who get upset about this, if people are drunk publicly and doing something inappropriate, obviously they should be stopped. But having, as you would call it, Marjorie, a cocktail outside on a terrific Boston day, and it's
going to
be pretty nice
on
Sunday. Go for it.
You have to stand on the stairs. You can stand outside your house on the stairs.
Is that literally?
Yes, I did some investigative reporting this morning with Peter Galsinis, who's lived on East
Broadway. From the Boston Herald, is that true?
For his whole life, has a big St. Patrick's Day parade party. Maybe I shouldn't have said that on the air.
Well, you did say it on the air.
But anyway, you can stand on the stairs.
So it's okay on the stairs, but it's not okay if you walk onto the sidewalk.
The moment you walk onto the sidewalk, actually a relative of his got ticketed. I think it's a $50 citation.
Marjorie, as a good Irish woman,
on the sidewalk.
Tell me the truth. Mm-hmm. Would you not on St. Patrick, I know you're going to be away. We'll mention that a little bit later this Sunday. But if you were in town and you were, whether it's at the parade itself or whether you're at some bar or some event or some mm-hmm. party in the back bay, wherever, you're telling me you wouldn't like to be able to walk out on the sidewalk and have a drink in your hand, talk to somebody from next door who's, I mean, how community oriented and great feelings.
Well,
I love that kind of thing.
I think what's happened is over the years, people that go to the parade with their kids and they're all excited have been sort of grossed out by what goes on over there. It is better. It is much better.
I mean, when it gets out of control, it should be stopped,
though.
When it
gets out of control. So the idea is, I mean, there are these 60 different organizations that have been pushing this family-friendly parade, and that's because they want to be able to have a family-friendly experience. You know, I don't mind the whole New Orleans idea if we were going to do
that.
Like
on Bourbon Street. Like shut down. Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Newbury Street, you know, from 7 to midnight in July and August, you could walk up and down Newbury Street. But this is like the big event for every college kid in Boston to come over and get blottoed, and that's what happens. So stand on the stairs with your cocktail, with your beer, with whatever you want, but don't stand on the sidewalk.
So it won't ruin the family friendliness as long as you're getting blottoed, to use your expression,
you know what you can do?
On the steps of a home in South Boston.
You can be ready to get the fine. You can walk down on the sidewalk, Jim, and take your chances. There are thousands of people at the parade. Only a few hundred get citations. So the odds are pretty good that if you sneak out there with your little cup, you won't be detected.
877-301-8970. If I say so, I think this is a wonderful idea. And by the way, we should give a shout out to Colin Kingsbury, who wrote about drinking at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in a Boston Magazine piece recently. I think he is dead on. Let's start with John in the car. Which side are you on, John?
Well, I'm first to Carrie Nation over there to your left. Come on.
That's right. I'm Carrie Nation.
You can already drink on a public street in Boston.
Where's
eight
that?
Times a year. You can drink between on Yawkey Way, between the gates on between Brookline Avenue.
You're absolutely right.
Which
they
is
fence
a great
it
idea.
Off, and it's great. And how great. You ever done that, Marjorie? How great is that in the summer,
I had
by the way?
It once. It was fun.
So are you buying into my larger view on this thing or no, John?
Well, as someone of direct Irish descent, yeah. I boycott the St. Patrick's Day Parade because just that's an idiot fest.
It is, exactly.
But as long as you're over 21, you're an adult, you should be allowed to do this. I mean, it's a ma'am, may I situation. And, you know, I went to New York 20 years ago when I drank in front of cops in the subway, and I thought it was one of the single greatest events of my life up to that point.
By the way, I'm not advocating for drinking alcohol in the subway.
I'm not saying everyone should have little paper bags and be able to walk down the street all the time. But head of the child, St. Patrick's Day, Boston Marathon, they are group events in this city, which make this city great.
John, you said it better than I. No, I'm totally with you, and thank you for the
John,
call.
John, I think you can get away with it on the marathon, though, because there's just not that many cops on the route. If you
but, you know, you keep saying
there,
your attitude is really frightening. Your position is we shouldn't have it unless you can sneak and get away with it, either on St. Patrick's Day or in the marathon. I'm saying let's be transparent about this thing. If it turns out people are drinking anyway and the cops are going to be there policing as they should the unruly crowd, why not make an event more fun? When you go to an event inside, do you
Jim,
have a drink, Marjorie?
We're supposed
do you have a
to
drink?
Be, we're supposed to be setting an example for the children.
Do you have a drink, Marjorie,
that you
inside?
You can have fun without having to resort
when you have a
to
party at your house
alcohol.
And your kids around. Do you have a drink?
Straight bourbon.
Okay. Exactly. So what's the difference?
Jack Daniels.
877.
Or Johnny Walker Red, if I'm
301-8970.
Martini.
877-301-8970. You know, by the way, she's making light of this. I am dead serious about this. I think it creates a much more wonderful social environment in Boston,
might,
and a more inviting city for younger people.
Just not there. I mean, you go over to the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and again, it is better than it used to be, but the chances of you're walking down the street with your kids and someone like falling horizontally on top of all of you, you know, you're taking a 50-50
okay,
shot.
Okay, so fine. So forget St. Patrick's Day. You mentioned this a minute ago. July and August, close down Newbury
I'm
Street
all for it.
And let people drink on the street. You're okay with it?
I'm all for marching fine. Up and down Newbury Street.
We're getting it. I'm not talking about marching. I'm talking.
Well, you don't want to march.
Whatever you do.
I guess that's the wrong image.
Oh, my goodness.
I guess, what are you supposed to do with a cocktail? I would say you're supposed to saunter.
You saunter.
Maybe you're supposed to sashay.
You saunter.
You're not supposed to march.
No, you're
I think
not.
That would accept the shaken, not stirred. Or is it stirred, not shaken?
Thank you very much. Let's go to Josh in Charlestown. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. And we're talking about whether public drinking, not drunkenness, should be allowed on things like St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Josh.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with so far what everybody is saying. It's a fine line that we have to walk on this one. We have a day, Bunker Hill Day, in June 17th to be exact, where mm-hmm. we have a big parade, same thing, and you know, I mean, people drink anyways, and they kind of do it under the cover of night right now, like Marjorie was saying. But I do think that within reason, if we were allowed to, I don't know if it would lessen the evil or if it would increase it. You know, it would be definitely be an interesting experiment to conduct to see if, you know, people would, once given their own tool? Would they use it against themselves, or would they use it to build something constructive? You know,
hey, Josh, kind of since you're a Charlestown guy and you mentioned Bunker Hill Day, I will ask you a question. I don't know if you remember former South Boston State Senator Jack Art, when there was a proposal on Beacon Hill to get rid of Bunker Hill Day, said if we got rid of Bunker Hill Day, quote, what's next, Thanksgiving and Christmas? Could you share that view that they were going to go to?
Yeah, they've been trying to get rid of it forever, and it ain't going anywhere.
Yeah, you know, they're hanging tough.
Josh, thanks.
I know Menino's not a fan of it, but it ain't going anywhere. There's no way.
Josh, we accept your prediction. Thank you so much.
You know what the irony of this conversation is, Jim Browdy? I mean, between the two of us, who's the big drinker here?
You're a much bigger drinker than I am, yeah.
And you have, like, for a man of considerable size.
Large size, yeah.
You know, you have half a beer.
And I'm out.
And you're sauced.
Exactly.
And you're 6'5" and 280 pounds.
I'm not 280 pounds. Either. Let's go to Carlos.
Okay, 260.
Whatever, 232, I'd say. Carlos in Dorchester, you are next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. What do you think about public drinking as long as it doesn't get out of control?
Well, you can't guarantee it's not going to get out of control, and it's out of control enough in Southie.
Exactly.
But first, I'd like to say I'm disappointed you're talking about the parade because it's a bigoted, homophobic affair.
Well, actually, let me just stop right there. One of the leaders on the other side who shares your view completely, Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows, is going to be with us at 1:30, and we're going to have a huge opportunity to discuss that very issue. But the reality is there is going to be a parade, Carlos. But go ahead.
Yeah, but the city shouldn't. I mean, if you're talking about an exception, a further exception the city would make for, the St. Patrick's Day parade, I think would be wrong. And by the way, I know you're gay, Jim. I happen not to be. And,
wait, you know that I'm gay? Well, by the way, that's news to me. But that
I didn't know you were gay.
This is a hell of a coming out moment for me. I wasn't even aware of it, by the way. But thank
you.
Go ahead, Carlos. No, I'm not.
No,
but
you
I'm
never
not.
Know, I guess.
I'm gay friendly, but gay I happen friendly. Not to be gay. Yeah. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Yikes.
But anyway, I think I live in Dorchester. People are drunk all the time. I can get drunk. I appreciate that.
Beautiful.
I appreciate that, and I think it's quite enough, frankly. But.
By the way, let me just say to you, Carlos, when Sue O'Connell, who's a good friend of mine and for years, finds out that I've been gay all these years and have never shared it with her, she is going to be shocked. Carlos, thank you.
Jim, it's a problem with the world is people, everybody should come out and people should accept everybody that comes out.
Exactly. Beautiful, Carlos.
I think you're,
thank you for the call.
I think you're protesting a little bit too much about this. Jim.
Our number is 877-301-8097. This conversation has degenerated a drop in part because of your attitude about it.
Really?
Margaret. No, but I'm serious. Even though, as I'm a fan of much of what Tom Menino has done through the years, I think he cares about the city a lot. Greg Selko from Karma Loop and his Future Boston Alliance have raised some pretty decent issues about making the city more 20 and 30 something friendly.
Yeah, you know how they can
opening
do that?
Up,
by keeping the tea open later. That would be a big advantage.
And one of
advantage.
His things also is keeping bars and restaurants open
bars
later.
Bars and restaurants should be
which
open
is a
later.
Very, but that's a variation on the same theme. And this notion, what Carlos is talking about, is it's already out of control. That's why we have police officers. When people get out of control, whether it's drinking or yelling or doing whatever it is, that's where they enter. But because there's some outliers, doesn't mean other people shouldn't be able to have fun.
I just think the St. Patrick's Day Parade is not the place to
start
this,
Fine. Then you do it in a place, whether, Newbury Street in the summer, wherever it is, it's a greater fun environment. Let's go to Dalton, who's in Wareham, I believe. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. What's happening, Dalton?
I'm calling.
You are.
I think that they... What's that?
You are. That's correct. I agreed with you. Go ahead.
That they should be allowed to... People should be allowed to have a beer and stand and watch the parade. I think that, most people are adults about it.
Yeah, that's where I got to disagree with it. I don't think most people are adults about it in the South Boston Parade. I think this has become like it's synonymous with let's go over and get as blotted as we can on East Broadway and the kids that are there and the residents that are there. It's just a mess. But thank you for the call. Anyway, Dalton, so we've taken our informal poll. What do you think? Who won?
In all seriousness,
I think
if there was a poll, I mean this seriously for a second, if there was a poll of the 600 and some thousand people of Boston and the other million or so who go in and out of Boston almost every single day, I bet you 80% of the people, including people who have young kids, would say as long as it's done responsibly, it creates a far better atmosphere, particularly in summer.
Jim,
I
think you should take a poll. And I didn't know, I've known you for many, many years.
Yes.
I didn't know you were gay until today. And it just goes to show you could be working closely with someone for years, have no idea. Okay.
I don't know where that came from with
Carlos. It's something completely different with Callie Crossley. She's going to tell us about the Pope, the poor, and the news that went under the radar this week. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This week in This American Life.
What would be wrong with one channel that showed nothing but puppies acting the natural comedians and cuties that they are all day, every day?
After 25 years as a businessman, one man starts from scratch to create a cable network with this theme song.
Puppies, 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 puppies.
The cutest, fuzziest radio story on earth. Puppies, 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 this week.
Tomorrow morning at 11, here on 89.7. WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Middlesex Savings Bank, offering a wide range of mortgage products, including jumbo loans up to $2 million. It's one more way Middlesex has helped build communities for more than 175 years. More at middlesexbank.com/mortgage.
Boston Public Radio is what you're listening to. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. But joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Friday, is Callie Crossley. She's host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which airs every single Sunday at 6:30 here on WGBH. We both listened to your first show, and it was spectacular. I hope you were happy with it, were you?
I'm very happy with it because I love my contributors, and we have a lot to say because it's a lot under the radar.
And by the way, one of your contributors last week just told us he's about to be unemployed in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Peter Katz.
Yeah, I know.
That?
I cannot believe
the
it.
Phoenix.
No, I'm heartsick.
It is for many reasons.
I'm heartsick.
It's horrible.
For him. Yes,
it's horrible. But tell us about Pope Francis. He big things made about him this week that he has always been, which is why he supposedly chose, or one of the reasons he chose Francis of Assisi, working with the poor and all that kind of stuff. But you're saying that he needs to deliver. So what do you mean by that?
Well, when I looked at all the coverage, I was, you know, struck, as many people were, about his humbleness, how he, you know, rides the bus, lived in the small apartment, cooked his own meals, and even after being named Pope, rode on the bus.
I love that.
And paid his own hotel bill and then rode back, you know, with everybody else. And it came over on the bus, I'm going back on the bus. So he's trying to live his individual life as one who speaks of a humility and a connection to the poor. He's gone out of his way washing the feet of AIDS patients. You know, doing that off. And I think that's great. Now, however, while he resides in some apartment they put him in, while they renovate the already sumptuous papal apartment, we know that that apartment is richly appointed with all the stuff that's in there. I mean, the guy cannot refuse that. How do you maintain what he himself has put forth as a central moral issue for someone like himself, and what I believe he believes for all Catholics, for the 1.2 billion Catholics, that poverty really should be a central concern. And I just don't know how he balances that. Now, one could argue that he's lived in a rich country, Argentina. I was looking at the World Bank report about the poor people in Argentina, and they titled it Poor People in a Rich Country. So he's had to do that balance somewhat, but that's as an individual. Now we're talking about you're really equal to a head of state. I hope to see him express what he lived his life as and tried to be the very embodiment as with regard to the poor on a national stage, using a platform to talk about the systems, the systemic kinds of systems that have enabled poverty to just be persistent.
I want to add one thing about his time in Argentina. I mentioned this yesterday, too. While he has been in fights with the president herself of Argentina over gay adoption, he's against them. But he is also, he being now Francis, has been in public fights with the husband of the president over just this very issue about income and wealth inequality in Argentina. But I want to get back to what you said. I know it'd be unheard of. Why can't he do, as Pope, exactly what he did as cardinal, what Sean O'Malley did as cardinal here, and say, listen, I respect all the traditions of the church, but I'm not comfortable living in that sort of splendor. I want to live in a room somewhere in the Vatican where I can be home. Why can't he? Wouldn't that make a statement that was colossal?
Margie's waving her hand. Yes, it would.
But here's what I think he can do. He can make the social justice issue, and the Jesuits are big on social justice issues, his big emphasis. Instead of talking about women and contraception and gays and yada, 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 talk about the poor. Say to these American bishops who sort of forgot about the poor because they were with Mitt Romney for the most of them. I think the American bishops have mostly all become Republicans. Make social justice and poverty issues in the United States huge. Bernard Law, no one liked him because he was, of course, the sex abuse crisis, and he did a terrible job on that. But I'll say one thing for Bernard Law. Every time they were trying to cut the welfare budget in Massachusetts or programs for the poor, he was up there on Beacon Hill.
Yeah, he was.
The Catholic Church has moved away from that, particularly in the United States. So if he could say, this is the preeminent issue, poverty and world poverty and what climate change is going to mean for the poor, and say to these American bishops, you know, lay off the gays for a minute, get on the poverty issues.
And let's see what work you're doing, because it's not about just saying it, though it is very important for him to say it and continue to say it. You know why? Because we in the media and nobody else covers it unless somebody keeps it on the platform. You know how many times poverty was covered as a substantive issue last year during the election campaign? 17 out of the thousands and thousands of articles that were written.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, off the table unless there is somebody talking about it and demonstrating through his own life. But he's got to talk about it more beyond his individualness. So to your point about Bernard Law, that's looking at it systemically.
Yeah.
What are the mechanisms by which we continue to keep a foot on the neck of a lot of people, and they can't rise up from it? You know what? 50% of the world population lives on less than $2.50 a day. 50%.
I don't think I could do that, Jim.
No, I don't think so.
So, I mean, it's big. It's something that he could tackle. It's something that he could say. And he can position it. I mean, he's supposed to position it through a faith tradition. I mean, Christ said, the poor will always be with you, but not with me. Meaning that the responsibility, I'm going to be gone from this earthly life. But the responsibility remains with those of you who believe in a faith tradition. And there's plenty of room for people who don't believe, by the way. You know, it's a moral issue. It is a faith issue. It's all of that. But he can just drum this and say it and, you know, speak from that balcony and go around the world and go to those places and illustrate it. And it can be covered and raised up in the way that will make a difference.
There are also two concrete things he could do. I assume we were talking about whether or not he has to live in splendor. He's the boss. He obviously can do whatever he wants. How many cardinals are there? A couple hundred? I know there are 115 or 80 below 80, or 80 below. Let's assume there are 200 cardinals around
many.
The world.
That's too many.
Why shouldn't he direct those cardinals that in the spirit of Christ, as you said a minute ago, you should live not unlike how I lived when I was in Buenos Aires? Let him do that. That'd be a one. I mean, can you imagine that image?
That's number one.
Number two, you know, we think in this country, in the United States of America, that we have more enlightened attitude about that. I was reading something this morning because I knew what you wanted to talk about. In 2011, Barack Obama didn't mention the poor or poverty. It was only the second time since Harry Truman's State of the Union, this is the State of the Union I'm talking about, in 1948, that a speech by a Democratic president didn't mention it. This time, he said, and this is from Obama, many places people live on a little more than a dollar a day, just like you said, Kelly. So the United States will join with our allies to eradicate such extreme poverty in the next two decades. Let Francis say, I'm going to not only hold my cardinal's feet to the fire, I'm going to hold the feet of world leaders to the fire.
Exactly.
Not just those in some of the worst countries, but in some of the most enlightened countries.
And I think his own bishops. To the fire. And I think that could make a huge difference. If instead of associating the Catholic Church with everything about sex, if they could associate it with everything about poverty and social justice, it would change. Because that's when I am so proud of the Church, is when they step up on these social justice issues and they hardly ever do it anymore.
Well, remember during the election, the nun, I'm sorry, I read
the nun. Yes, she was great.
She was on a
the nun on the bus. The nun on
the
bus
saying the poverty is the issue, the poor are the mm-hmm. issue. That's what we stand for as Catholics. I mean, and you're absolutely right, Jim. He has a platform now, and I would hope that he would do it. Remember that St. Francis, from whom he's taken his name, abandoned all wealth and lived among the beggars. Where? At St. Peter's Basilica. Mm.
And he was. He was from a family of great wealth, was he
yes.
not, Francis?
You know, I mean, yeah. there you have it. That's right at St. Peter's Basilica.
This is the kind of stuff that makes Marjorie beam. The best of Catholicism. I've known this woman for a long time. Creates a huge smile on her face. Can we change gears just for a second and make it much more local? I know you have, I wouldn't say a fixation. Maybe
oh,
you
no,
can describe
fixation,
it.
Obsession.
Fixation.
Yes.
Porter Square Bookstore, yes. where I've spent a lot of time in the Porter Square Me Mall, too. An odd mall, mm-hmm. but in Porter Square. It's not closing down, but it's looking for buyers.
Right.
And it brings to light what I know Marjorie cares a lot about, too, the fate of the independent bookstore in the age of the chains, in the age of the Amazons of the world. You reflect on it. You care about this a lot.
Oh, my God. I'm obsessed with books. I just did three purges of my book collection because it was, you know, closing me in my house. But I still have hundreds. I love Porter Square Books. I love Harvard Bookstore. Here's the good news for those of us in this area. The Harvard Bookstore was bought by a new owner in 2008. Jeff Meyerson and his wife, Linda Simonson. And then the same thing happened to the Wellesley Booksmith in 2011. And the same thing happened for another store that I'm just blanking on right now.
Brookline. Is it Brookline Booksmith?
No, it was Wellesley Booksmith. And also Curious George came back.
Right.
Oh, so Curious George is great.
In Harvard Square. So there are opportunities. Oh, the Mobile Book Fair. Out in Newton.
In Newton.
Got a new owner.
One of the great places.
Yes.
It's a dump, but it is just... No, it is fabulous.
Love it. Love it.
Is it New England Mobile Book Fair?
New England Mobile. So there's a possibility of doing that. Now, that does not mean to say that all of those places I named are having an easy go of it, because fighting Amazon is no joke. They're going to get some relief in November when the law changes, and Amazon then has to do the 6.25 sales tax in Massachusetts. So that'll even the playing field for local people who are trying to buy books, which I am thrilled about, as a matter of fact.
Two of the three of us are thrilled about that, Kelly. I won't tell you who isn't.
Here's my question, though, because this is an ethical dilemma for a lot of us. I got an iPad for Christmas, and of course I can download books instantly onto my iPad. And I'm feeling, you know, a little uncomfortable about it because I'm getting them for cheaper than I would be if
But don't you buy books as well?
I buy books as well.
So there you go. I'm bookaholic everywhere. So I download, I buy lots of books. I cannot go in a bookstore and not buy.
But aren't we putting them out of business?
No,
by doing
not
this?
If you make certain that your a good part of your purchasing comes to and supports independent bookstores. So I go out of my way, certainly at the holiday times, to make sure that's coming to the independent bookstores. If I have to, you know, get a book and they don't have it on, you know, iPad or whatever, and I don't have to have it immediately anyway, because I'm very choosy about what goes on the iPad, then I go to the independent bookstores. And so we gotta support.
Yeah.
If we say we want them, we gotta support them.
Brookline Booksmith, love it. I'm there all the time.
And you know, Porter Square as well as, and by the way, they're not selling because of lack of profitability. We need to put that out
older,
there.
Right? Because
now,
they're aging
well, a couple
out of,
of
it,
people
right?
would like to retire, but they are profitable. So that's a good business for somebody because they have made themselves what independent bookstores do, a part of the community.
Well, they have these great programs, and they have
author
series and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
I think it's sort of a dating scene, too, on Saturday night.
No, actually, it's a huge thing.
People hang out in the stacks, and they're looking at
coffee
books,
shop at
looking
Porter
at each
Square.
Other,
yeah.
looking at the books.
Do you, know what I mean? When you were saying to Kelly a minute ago, Marjorie, that you have some compunctions when you're downloading a book because you get it right away and it's cheaper, that sort of stuff.
Right.
You work for the Boston Herald.
Right.
The Boston Herald's been in financial difficulty off and on, and you worry about that because you love the paper, you love your job, that sort of thing. Do you not say to yourself, you're doing what everybody does who goes to bostonherald.com and reads the Marjorie Egan column for free?
That's why I have the moral dilemma because
I feel...
You just got
to put your money where your mouth is.
So that means I can't download anything.
No, it means that you have to make certain that you are purchasing. That's what it means.
Okay.
I'm with Kelly.
You know, that's what it means.
You can be pure and impure at the same time.
You can be 70% pure and 90% pure.
Well, I would say
like
you could be 90% pure.
Okay,
how about
90%
that? Let's work
pure.
Toward 90.
Okay.
You should be the czarina of the book, Kelly. People should come to you and say, may I download this book or at this rate? How many have you bought lately? And where do you have to do it?
Well, you do think about how many books you want in your bookshelf.
Absolutely.
Because you want your bookshelves to be attractive.
Let me just say.
I mean, I have a rule. Hardcover is downstairs, Peter Beck's upstairs.
I got them. I have it all. You know, here is the super credential of any bibliophile.
What?
When the guy comes to move you, he says, "Lady, are you kidding? Are you really kidding me? All these books. Come on now."
Well, but that's a good story. I just want to. Marjorie mentioned you want your bookshelves to be attractive.
Yes.
My uncle, who pretty helped raise me, I should say, in Philadelphia. My uncle was married to a woman for a while, who I guess was my aunt for that period of time, who loved books, too. When they moved into a new apartment, it was sort of an upgrade for them. This is a totally true story. I was a little boy. I went with her to the bookstore because they had bookshelves built in. Honest to God, she said the following. She says, "I want 11 blue books. I want 15 red books," because she wanted the bookshelves to look.
Oh, that's too bad.
That is. But at least she kept them in business. Kelly Crossley, 6:30 Sunday night is the second edition of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. What are you doing?
Okay, so we have a great Under the Radar story. So there's a guy, for all people who are still angry about those banks being bailed out and not seeming to, you know, give back any of the money to we taxpayers. So Mr. Andrew Hall lives in Vermont, but he used to be an oil trader with Citigroup, where he got a $100 million payout. Okay, why does that mean anything to any of us? Well, he's buying up the town of Reading, Vermont, and making little soaps and maple syrups and all of that. And some people are not happy about it. Other people are saying, well, it's an infusion of cash in the community. But his payout was so huge that even Kenneth Feinberg, who oversaw the compensation for these banks, thought it was ridiculous. So it's a kind of,
$100 million.
He did the 9/11 fund too, Feinberg.
Yes. You know, so with Kenneth Feinberg has to comment on your pay, you know, that's really something.
Okay, what else you got?
Well, I got other stuff, but I'm not saying it all. Okay. I'm keeping it under the
radar. Exactly.
Okay,
6:30 to 7 Sunday night, Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. We'll be listening. We'll talk to you again next Friday. Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, it's Open Mic with Emily Rooney. We'll talk her take on the Whitey Bulger trial. When can you call somebody elderly in public transportation? That and more on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Join WGBH and the Huntington Theater Company for PRI's Selected Shorts on Tour. Tales of Springtime, Sex and Baseball.
An evening of short stories about both of our national pastimes.
As read by acclaimed actors like Amy Ryan, Kate Burton, and Tony Award winner Dennis O'Hare.
Support Boston Public Radio with a gift of $100 right now, and we'll say thanks with a pair of tickets to either the 4 p.m. or 8 p.m. show on June 8th.
But seating is limited. Visit WGBHnews.org for more.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And the NHPTV Ticket to Ride car raffle. The grand prize is a 2013 Ford Fusion or Honda Accord. For complete rules and other information, you can visit nhptv.org/raffle.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. This is Open Mic, and we're joined by a woman who literally 7 days ago told us she had never taken public transportation in her whole
Actually,
life.
Actually, 14 days ago.
Whatever it was, 14 days ago. Who cares? And went on vacation for 1 week, Marjorie. And what did she do?
She took public transportation. It was very convenient. It took me to where I wanted to go, unlike the transportation out here where there's no way to get
there
from here.
By the way, that's Emily Rooney, host of Greater Boston, if you didn't notice.
They used to have, because I got in a conversation with one of the drivers, the largest free public transportation system in the country. I don't think that's true any longer, but it's a very convenient service. It's free.
It's a bus?
It's a great little bus, you know, it's kind of a trolley-sized
bus. How did it
bus.
Feel after all these
I've
years?
I've been on that one before.
I have.
That one.
So kind of an exciting development in the Whitey Bulger trial that may never happen at the rate we're going. But, a federal appeals court judge just removed Judge Richard Stearns from the case. He was, of course, a former federal prosecutor, and some people were worried about fairness in this trial.
Appearance of a conflict of interest.
Yeah, do you think it was the right thing to do?
You know,
I have to say, I've known Rick Stearns for 30 years, and this guy has the most stellar reputation of any prosecutor judge in the world. And I have to say, I'm putting myself in his shoes for a minute, and I'm thinking, what if some federal court ruled that I could never do a story about CBS News because my father once worked there? It's like, what? You're telling me I can't be impartial? I can't be independent? I can't have my own, you know, separate thoughts from the fact that I once worked for a department that pursued the guy? Having said that, I totally understand the appearance of a conflict of interest. And in many ways, I wish Rick Stearns had taken himself out of this, because it seemed inevitable that that's the way a federal district court was going to rule.
I have to say, Harvey Silverglade is quoted in the Globe today. I am so with him. And this is not to disparage the Judge Stearns. This is a, quote, no-brainer. The criteria, if people don't know in these kinds of things, is there bias? And there clearly is no evidence of bias. Is it reasonable for the public to believe that there's a problem with impartiality? No, but the public.
This has to do with Whitey Bulger's trial. The public, their opinion doesn't matter.
It does matter in terms of a court's decision.
The public was not upset about this. J.W. Carney was upset about this.
That's the lawyer for Whitey Bulger.
No one else cared.
But first of all, the person who wrote this decision, for those who don't know, is David Souter, former Supreme Court judge from New Hampshire. He stepped down, and now he sits on these appellate courts from time to time. Mm-hmm. It does matter. I mean, faith in an institution.
I just said appearance of a conflict of interest. I agree with you.
Okay,
and I wish Rick Stearns had taken himself out because there was an inevitability to this.
But how can
he
you say
have, because he can be fair, he can be impartial.
Yeah, but,
I have no doubt about
that. If you say, for those who are unfamiliar with the facts in this case, Rick Stearns was head of the criminal division of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the 80s. At the same time that the organized crime strike force in the same office, but independent, theoretically, independent of that, was having this relationship with Whitey Bulger. And when Stern said, and when he decided himself not to remove himself, I didn't even know that this thing was going on. One, I don't think, with all due respect to Stearns, that passes the credibility test. And secondly, the appellate court, Emily, invited Judge Stearns to appear before them to make his own case, and he chose not to do it.
Of those judges, as you know, Jim, are above it all.
No, but if they're invited by other judges,
they're not going to do it. They're not going to go in there and defend their reputation and their ability to be fair and impartial. This is never going to happen.
But you know what the thing is with this case, and I think it makes it unique in many ways. As everybody knows, it's followed the Whitey Bulger case. The FBI in Boston was totally corrupted by Whitey Bulger, or they corrupted themselves, whatever you want to look at it. I think the U.S. Attorney's Office and the federal courts are looking so creepy lately because of this Aaron Swartz case. I mean, one has got nothing to do with the other, but it's about the federal court system and the Federal Bureau of Investigation being so compromised. So maybe the public doesn't care now, but I think it's
There's no question. If something had gone wrong in this trial, the judge could have been blamed. And that's why
exactly.
He needed to take himself out. He should have recused himself. And that's what's kind of tragic about this, because he put himself in a position where he was forced out. And I'm sure he is really, really annoyed, to put it mildly.
Well, what
but he should have
case.
Done it himself.
I mean, imagine.
Do you guys think it's going to delay the trial? It's got to.
Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, said she didn't think so.
Oh, bull.
But I'm so with you. One,
she's
there are hundreds
of
thousands of documents.
Yeah.
Two, if I'm Jay Carney, the lawyer you mentioned a minute ago, you say, I want to argue my motions
another
again.
Year.
They denied my motion, he would say, to allow my client, Whitey Bulger, to claim he was given immunity by the FBI. I want to argue that in front of the judge who is properly adjudicating this case.
And Jay Carney has been arguing for more time since the beginning of this.
I would have to give it to him. A new judge has not been appointed yet.
So Whitey could be like 90.
Yeah. He'll be 84 in September.
Is that? Yesterday I was off by 2 years.
I'm one of these people who knows birthdays.
Could be a long time away.
Yeah, but the one nice thing about this story I have to say is I know this is almost such a truism. How do you – these families – who are the survivors of the victims of this serial killer, alleged serial killer, Whitey Bulger? There's nothing that goes their way. I mean, for a minute they had this immunity ruling, and then that's gone.
That's why the judge should have taken himself out of it months ago. He could have put an end to this, and we would be rolling along towards a trial, and now we're back to square one.
Well, tell us about my favorite story of the day.
Yeah, this is
a
big
good one.
Dispute. Speaking of elderly.
Exactly.
And National Public Radio.
Public Radio. So this was a story last week. National Public Radio was doing a series about people who, for one reason or another, after the kind of natural age of retirement, 65, whatever, have had to continue working, or either voluntarily or sort of forced back into the workplace, divorces.
It's gonna be a lot of us.
You know, widows and that kind of thing. They had to go back to the workplace. So they did this a story about a midwife, and she's 71. So they did a news radio report, and then they did a piece for the website, and it said, 71-year-old elderly midwife continues working. Da, da, da. Well, this woman, Diane Sparling, got really upset. And she said, what do you mean? She said she was taken aback. She was aghast at being called elderly. So NPR got all over this. The ombudsman weighed in. The ombudsman agreed that that terminology should not be used. They took that away, although if you Google it, you can still, that can come up. So the issue, we're going to actually do it on Beat the Press tonight as well, is elderly kind of the new pejorative, like illegal alien or some of the other terms, you know, mentally retarded. Can you not call somebody elderly?
I think you can call them elderly when they're elderly. But well, if 71 elderly? Is the new 41 or whatever that overused expression.
It's not.
I don't want to insult Diane Sparling, I think her name is, but she looks elderly. You know, she's got the gray floppy hair and the translucent blue eyes, and she's just kind of She's transitioned into
that. So you say
that.
It's not
and
just
she,
chronological in this particular case.
Too. And
it's
she appearance. Talked about how difficult it was for her to be a midwife now because you're on call all the time. Yeah. I mean, you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go help a woman deliver
a baby.
But
she says she
baby.
Can still do it.
She can still do it. I always thought elderly was 65, be over 65. Because
maybe
65
years ago
seriously,
was.
Do you want to be called elderly anytime
no,
soon?
No, I don't want to be called elderly. We're all going to the gym
yeah,
trying
exactly.
to go on forever.
Exactly. But I just got back from skiing. Don't call me elderly.
Okay, I won't call you I
why
won't
does
call
it have to say any? Why is there need to be a modifier at all? I mean, you mentioned a yeah. couple of ups when we were talking about yeah. this upstairs in the newsroom, how it drives you. I don't want to put words yeah. in your mouth. How it drives you nuts when they describe someone as a grandmother
that
when her being a grandmother has
crazy.
Nothing to do with the underlying
well, they,
story.
They do it. The Boston Herald in particular, to Marjorie does
I know.
This.
I wrote a column.
48-year-old grandmother. It's like, what's it got to do with this? Oh, it's so much sadder if you're a grandmother. But it also puts this kind of feeling that you're old, you're over the hill, you're kind of like you're past your prime because you're a grandmother. It's like it doesn't matter how old you are. It's like,
well, you know, one of the things I argued in the paper, because we were always calling Elizabeth Warren Granny Warren.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God.
And one of the things I argued is that the grannies may have put her over the top because so many people, women, were insulted by that terminology, implying that she was too old to be the senator or something like that.
Of course,
like
I made the point that Howie Carr was a grandfather, but he's never seen his grandchild.
Oof.
Ooh.
That's true, too.
Oof.
Hey, so but you didn't answer my question. But I'm here. Why do we need any modifiers? Why does a newspaper art? Why does it need to it says 71-year-old
well,
woman so and so? What
you don't,
I mean, I think
really,
we know when
that,
you're 71, you're sort
you're
of
71.
On the older side. You're yeah, 71. Yeah.
So is it better to be old or elderly?
It's better to be
or
neither.
Have senior
is what
senior
I'm saying.
I hate that word. I hate that. Yeah. Let's not call it the sunset years though anymore, because for most people, it's not the sunset years because they're still having to go to work. There are no more sunset
but
years.
But here's another thing: when you read a newspaper article, are you desperately searching for the age of somebody like? A wind tour
oh,
or somebody like that.
Of course
you want to go?
You're
how
not?
Old are?
Of course.
How old is she?
63.
Wow, she looks fantastic.
Yeah, well, you know, she's on the don't eat diet, so it's like.
Well, that raises another interesting question. By the way, if elderly is not necessary in a story,
oh.
and if grandmother is not necessary in a story, even unless
why is an
the
age?
Thing, why is
it's
age?
It's a point of information. I always feel very strongly about this. That anything that adds a point of information, and I hate to say it, your age is, then it's
well, why isn't being a grandmother a point of information?
Well,
it
because usually it has something to do with some bizarre crime or something. And it's like, what's that got to do?
Well, I think it's almost sexist
also,
in a way.
Also, you can say you're a grandmother, if you, but it's always, you know, 57-year-old grandmother. It's like, you know what? Like, it's not the first point of information that's relevant to the story.
I think we should put people's weights in
yes,
story.
There you go. That's
Anna
point of Wintour, information.
63.
I heard you say Jim weighs about 280.
I do not. By the way, if you had a guess,
and he's
are you one of those
I'm
people?
I'm pretty good at this.
Are you, okay, fine. What do you think I weigh?
Because I know what my father weighed, and he was only 5'8".
Okay, he's 6'5".
Your father was only 5'8"?
My father was only 5'8".
I only
eight.
Ever
he
saw him
220.
Sitting down. No, he did not.
Absolutely. He was a fire plug.
Andy Rooney
never
weighed
got under 220
pounds?
In his life. Never was under
okay,
200 pounds.
Okay, I'm ready. Marjorie, please stay out of this.
264.
Marjorie, I'm talking to our guest.
I just said 264.
No.
Yes.
No.
274.
No, Marjorie, this is not your guess. It's a little lower than 260. Let's just leave it
248.
There.
248.
Did you hear one of the callers say he was gay?
Yeah, I did. I'll attest to that.
Can we?
That's
let's talk
true.
About someone's younger, if we can, for a second.
As far as we know.
Maybe 250.
Never know.
I'm not
I don't
sure.
know.
Gabriel Gomez yeah. is the stealth candidate for the Republican nomination to succeed John Kerry. And yesterday, a letter, or maybe in the last couple of days, a letter he wrote to Deval Patrick seeking the interim Senate position that Mo Cowan ended yeah. up getting came to light, and some conflicts came to light. There are two that are right here. One, in the letter to Deval Patrick, he said he supported President Obama's position on guns and immigration, when in fact, on the campaign trail, he says he's against an assault weapons Stevens Band. That was one. Number two, and this is arguably more problematic, he said in a letter to Deval Patrick, after he praised Deval Patrick, that he supported President Obama in 2008. And he said in his announcement and on the campaign trail that, no, he voted, quote, for the Navy guy. John McCain. Yesterday, Allison King did a great story on this in NECN. Allison asked him to explain what did he mean by saying he supported Obama if he didn't vote for Obama. And here's his, I guess, explanation.
What I meant by I support the president, what I meant was that I support that the fact that the president is now finally, he campaigned on this before, but he didn't do anything in the first term. He's now elevating this to a national discussion.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
I don't know,
about.
But my guess is he voted for Barack Obama. And what a sycophant. Writing to the governor?
I know.
I mean, it's one thing that I did it, but it's like...
No, you know what's worse? What almost nobody has commented on? Have you seen an actual copy of the letter he sent to the governor?
No.
On the letter and the copy everybody's read, there is a photograph of Gabriel Gomez. Instead of, you know, one of those things at the top of the thing where you have, like,
his
your
picture?
Name and your address and your phone number, it has his photograph in the top
right-hand
corner.
What do you think when you get
corner?
Resumes with people with their photographs?
You throw them it's out, like, yeah, don't exactly. you? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, but many people thought because he's a Navy SEAL, he's great-looking in the tradition of Scott
that's why
Brown.
Not only is he a Navy SEAL, he's only one of two who transitioned from landing from airplanes on aircraft carriers to Navy SEAL. I think this is encouraging for politicians. You could be the ultimate macho military guy and still fall flat in your face when you run for public
office. Well,
meanwhile, the bigger issue now for him is that people are bailing off his ship.
Right, I mean, two women from his women's thing.
Fairly prominent people are saying, well, wait a second. This is not a straight answer, and we don't believe him. I mean, my bet is he did vote for Barack Obama. When you say you supported somebody, that's what you mean.
Right.
And that answer he just gave to Allison King, he didn't say he didn't vote for him.
No, he's trying to explain it in a totally convoluted way. So my issue is, what's the over-under and how much longer he's in this campaign? I would say he doesn't make it through the weekend. And by the way, to my knowledge, and I hope I'm not embarrassed when you tell me otherwise, Emily. to my knowledge, of the five candidates for United States Senate, he's the only one that has not done a sit-down interview with a reporter
not
or an
me.
Anchor anywhere. Well, not me, and I don't think anybody else. How long is
I mean, I haven't had a one-on-one with Ed Markey yet. I know he called into the radio show, but that's not the
same.
Well,
I had a one-on-one with him two Fridays ago.
Oh, you did.
But that was the first. I'm sorry, Emily. You brought
How'd that
it up
go
again.
For you, Jim?
What?
How'd that go for
Best
you?
Best 15 minutes of my life,
there
actually.
You go.
No, but in all, how does the guy survive? I mean, not only with
he's
the
not
people, he's
going
gone,
to
right? Is he not gone?
I think he's gone. Yes, I do.
How about you, Emily Rooney?
I don't think it matters.
What do you mean it doesn't
matter?
Matter.
He's not going to get a vote anyway. It doesn't matter. He's kind of good to look at. Keep him in the race.
Well, I'll tell you why. I think it does matter.
He is good looking.
This is total speculation.
I'd like to have him stick around for that first debate.
The first debate was the
televised
debate.
No, there's a mixed debate coming in, televised debate.
The reason I think it does matter, actually, and I mean this sincerely, in light of the fact that he doesn't talk to anybody, I'm assuming, and he's involved in a business that suggests to me, I don't know this for a fact, that he's got some money. I'm assuming he's planning
money.
On spending a ton of money on advertising if he's not
so
talking to anyone.
Let's keep him around.
Well, but that's keep him around to what, to come in third?
To, you know, stoke up the coffers for the local TV and radio stations.
That's
oh, that's a good
point.
Idea. That's a good idea. You do have the, and he's very smart, you know, went to Harvard Business School and all that sort of thing.
How do you know, based on what, I'm not saying he
well,
isn't.
Usually you're
what
pretty
is the experience
smart.
Based, that you base his brain
I just
power
don't think
on.
It's that easy to get into Harvard Business School. I think it's a pretty tough nut to crack.
Oh, we want to stick him around for a little. We don't know anything about him. I think this is going to blow over. It's certainly not through the weekend. He doesn't.
Well, you know, we always talk about moderate Republicans around here. I mean, maybe he. I don't know what his positions
I don't think,
are. No,
excuse
on
me.
Issues.
I don't think the issue is whether he's a moderate Republican, whether you can win a primary.
Okay,
I think whether he's an honest Republican. I'm for an
Jim.
Assault weapons ban. I'm against an assault weapons
he's
ban.
He's confused. He's confused.
You're the most charitable woman in the media. Okay, speaking of travel, which we did a couple of minutes ago with you, Emily Rooney, and your public transportation thing, TSA announced what I assume is going to be a fairly not controversial policy a couple of weeks ago. They're going to allow you to carry hockey sticks and well, actually, you're an athlete, and golf clubs and things. But most controversially, and again, I didn't think it was going to be controversial, little pen knives to up to 2.5 inches.
Yeah.
Amazingly, a couple of people like Chuck Schumer from New York, I think.
People going crazy
Ed Markey
over this.
Going crazy over this. And so I don't know if they're going to revise their policy or not. But what's your take on all this?
I mean, I can't believe that they put pocket knives above some other things. Like, I like to take a full tube of sunscreen. You still can't do that.
I'm so with you.
You can't take a full...
Liquid's over 3 ounces,
They
right?
take it from you. Once I had, like, Nivea, and honest to God, there was only, like, a little scraping in the bottom of it. But the container was bigger than 3 ounces, even though I said, look, there's less than 3 ounces of junk in here. Nope, they take it. So I'd like to be able to take the stuff. And then Marjorie and I have this issue about this stupid, just absolutely ridiculous, moronic, moronic rule about taking your shoes off.
Oh, shoes off. That's
it's
a problem.
It's just, it doesn't work for anybody.
Doesn't.
And it's filthy and disgusting. And it's if you've got bad feet, like Marjorie and I, we can
that's
say
right.
that, right?
And like, we want to keep our
disgusting.
Feet to ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I happen to have great feet, but I'm with you, actually. But also, if you happen, I mean, you walk on this disgusting floor.
Yeah, exactly. They're not prepared for you to take your shoes off.
And your belts, and you're loading everything into these bins, and it's a rush, and it's so stressful.
It's embarrassing,
I hate
too.
To fly. I want to take the train
but
everywhere.
I have stopped taking off. You know how they used to make you take, like, the sweater and this? I don't do that anymore.
Good for
and
you.
Nobody says anything.
Oh,
and
that's not, excuse me. I was in Chicago a couple of
really?
Weeks ago. I had to take my jacket off.
No, I
and
don't
put
do
it
that
in the
anymore.
Bin.
Well, you
no.
always get stopped.
And what was?
I think because you give them a hard time.
Because I weigh 230
I had on
pounds.
A
is that why?
I had on a t-shirt and a jacket, both coming and going. I refused to take the jacket. Nobody said it.
If they had
a coat on, I took the coat off.
Let's do a hypothetical, yeah. Emily Rooney and Marjorie again. If we had a high-risk lane where you sign a little thing in advance once a year saying, I'm willing to take whatever risk is incumbent with this. You just fly right through like in the old days.
I would do
which
it.
You do
absolutely.
It in a second, right?
Yeah, me
absolutely.
Too. Me too.
Marjorie and I, we can't name the airline. In our former place of employment, we took about a dozen listeners to Philadelphia on a trip.
Oh, really?
And on this, you don't remember this?
I do.
On the small airline, we're looking around for the security. And it comes from another airport,
yeah, yeah.
The Chalby Rum, unnamed outside Boston. And it's a commercial airline, not little security.
No security.
And we were told we couldn't mention that fact.
Because it was
no
a charter?
Security. Well, I guess, I don't
very
know if it's
small,
a charter.
Because I was on a charter once. Absolutely
and they don't,
none.
No
zero, zero, nothing. Yep.
Yeah. Very just small nothing. Plane. People were looking around at each other on that plane. Particularly
yeah.
you, Jim.
Yeah.
They're
no, I had
the
same experience.
Yeah.
By the way, we were just told by our colleagues in the control room that according to Shelley Murphy from the Boston Globe, where'd she used to work, Marjorie?
She used to work at the Boston Herald.
Oh,
thank
the
you.
The trial's going to be delayed.
Judge Denise Casper. She's a
Denise
former
Casper.
Federal prosecutor.
Uh-oh.
Who became a judge just in December of 2010. Takes over the Whitey Bulger case. I'm about to embarrass myself and say I've never heard
neither
of
neither
Casper.
Have I. But
yeah, I find out when was she with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
Well, that's going to be a big
that's
issue
a good
because if he was a federal prosecutor, Stearns was back
in the
80s.
Yeah.
She was probably more recent.
I would
more
assume,
recent.
Well, if she was appointed in just 2010, yeah. I would assume that's the case. So again, Judge Denise Casper, former federal prosecutor, became a judge in December of 2010, obviously meaning she was appointed by Barack Obama, takes over the Whitey Bulger case.
You know, I have one quick question for
yeah.
you, Emily, before you go, because we're going to talk about it in a minute, these little snafus on these Carnival cruise lines.
Oh, yeah.
Would you ever book a Carnival cruise, given
no,
what's
No, I have this.
Lately?
This is really crazy. I have this, like, food phobia. So when it comes to, like, these great big, like, buffets and all this food, yes, I would have to jump overboard. I wouldn't be able to do it because it's like, what else do you do? You're going to run around the ship a couple times and then get in line at your... I could never
you mean
do
you're
it.
Worried about eating the food out of yeah. those containers? Because other people
no,
might be sticking their forks in.
No, it's also that there are 24-7 buffets.
Yeah.
You go
there
from one
no
buffet
overload.
To the
That's
chocolate
the
buffet if, to the breakfast
you've it,
buffet.
You've got it.
And I am...
I couldn't do it.
At 211 pounds.
Yeah.
I like... Those guys. Can you put your shoes on before you leave?
Exactly.
By the way? Emily Rooney, what are you doing tonight? On you want to
yeah.
tell us anything else on Great?
Well,
on,
we are going to do the elderly
Press?
Thing, so we've got the examples of that Diane Sperling, whatever that is.
And
so.
You're doing the Phoenix.
And of course,
I assume,
we're
going
to talk the Phoenix.
The
and,
Phoenix.
And,
how sad.
And some fun
how
stuff
sad.
With Matt Lauer, who's in line to be. I bet you didn't know this. The next host of Jeopardy.
No, is that true?
Matt. Lauer?
It's the job I wanted my
Why?
Whole life,
Me too.
By the way. Oh, my God.
You don't have to know the answers. You just have to pretend you do.
He's sick of getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever
he
it is.
He's going to get fired, Marjorie. Where you been?
I did not know
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Not happy.
Because of the
ratings.
He
didn't handle Ann Curry terribly well either.
Yeah.
Hey, Emily Rooney,
right.
It was a pleasure. We'll be watching tonight, and we'll see. Oh, and actually, you're sitting in for Marjorie a few days
oh, I am.
Next
That's
week.
That's right.
You're right.
Emily and
wrong.
Jerry.
Are you taking evacuation day off?
I'm taking evacuation day off.
That's what
That's
it is.
Right. Absolutely.
Hey, Emily, thanks. We'll see you tonight.
Okay.
Emily
She's Emily Rooney. She's with us every Friday for Open Mic at 1 o'clock. And on Monday, we've got Open Mic with Eugene Rivers. Moving on to Carnival Cruise. After all this fetid mayhem that happened on a Carnival cruise line in February, why would anybody want to test their luck on one of these luxury vessels? We're going to have that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Bad as the recession was for us, the grown-ups, Think for a second about the kids.
When these parents are going through a lot of stress dealing with the economic situation that they're in, a lot of them do their best to shield their kids from it. But of course, the kids can't be shielded from the water being turned off.
I'm Kai Rizdal. No water, no heat, no power, no home. A new documentary about families and the financial crisis next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Bunker Hill Community College, providing more than 105 degrees and certificates. For more information, you can visit bhcc.mass.edu. Bunker Hill Community College. Imagine the possibilities. And the law firm of Wolfe Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolfe Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com.
Listen to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, many journalists, Marjorie, have mistakenly reported that Feng Hua has gone out of business. Here's my assessment. They no longer do buses to New York City, but they're in the cruise business, and they've changed their name to Carnival Cruise. You all know the story. In mid-February, they had this disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Listen to this.
The toilet situation was pretty bad. They told us to go in showers. The boat started tilting, so you couldn't really do that anymore because of the drain. So they told us to go in sinks, and they handed out bags for us. People were sleeping in hallways and stairwells. We were sleeping by the lifeboats. Old people were just stuck by the stairs in their wheelchairs. It was really sad.
Sounded like a great cruise. That, of course, was the Carnival Triumph. And a month later, there was the Carnival Dream. It lost. Well, listen to this. This is a passenger on the Dream.
The toilets and everything started overflowing down in the main general lobby areas where people were frequenting the bathroom.
We want to know
if
you can at 877-301-8970. Marjorie's been on a cruise, so she knows a little bit about what she's talking about. I cannot understand why any sane human being would decide in, what is it, March of 2013 to say, hey, you know what I want to do? I want to go on a Carnival cruise. 877-301-8970. By the way, even before these mishaps, I'll be euphemistic. Mm-hmm. I don't like the captive nature of the thing. Even though I'm a big eater, what Emily Rooney just said, I don't like the fact that it's 24/7 buffets of all types. But the notion that there's malfunction after malfunction after malfunction, not to mention, which is not a Carnival ship, the Costa Concordia
a couple of years ago. Which tipped over.
Who does this? And people died. Who does this kind of thing?
Well, because you don't expect this to happen. I mean, Carnival does have sort of a checkered history here. Back in 2010, there was the Carnival Splendor. That was another diesel generator. The Coast Guard apparently has responded to 90 marine casualty incidents involving the Carnival in the Carnival cruise lines in the last 5 years. It was a great quote from a guy. I guess he told his friends a couple of weeks ago. He was on this most recent one this week. And he told his friends a couple of weeks ago, you know, he's going on a Carnival cruise. I said, what, are you nuts? And the guy tells CNN, what are the odds of it happening to two ships in such a short period of time? Now he knows the odds. They're very, very good.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I would never do it. I'm going to ask Marjorie in a minute if she would again. I think the answer is no. If there's somebody out there that wants to make the case for going on a cruise at this point, particularly a Carnival cruise, please give us a buzz. And I know it's a one stop. It's 877-301-8970. I assume the allure, and you've done it, is that it's a one stop. I mean, in addition to the ports, everything's there. Essentially,
right.
It's a hotel. You're all your restaurants there, all the recreation.
They have great shows. I mean, they have unbelievably talented. You go to the same dinner spot to eat every night, and then the waiters break into song as they're serving you your dinner. It's unbelievable. You go to these shows, it's like Las Vegas, where unbelievably talented singers, dancers, comedians get up. And you think to yourself, why are they on this cruise ship? I guess they must pay them pretty well or something. But that's it, which is really neat. Then they have places like Johnny Rockets. Your kids can go there at midnight and get a cheeseburger. They love it.
So would you do it again?
Well, I wouldn't go on a Carnival cruise. I think I want to go to Royal Caribbean. I went in a Royal
Caribbean
cruise.
But you do it again on
another
cruise?
Well, I wasn't crazy about it. You're kind of herded onto the boat and off the boat. And it takes, because there's thousands of people on the boat, it takes you, you know, an hour, 2 hours to get on the boat and off the boat. But they have their own little islands that they,
I understand,
know,
the ports of call. I understand that.
And we went to that Atlantis down in the Bahamas, and that was really neat. And I love going there, and the kids loved it. So
And the rooms aren't as small as you think. The showers are kind of tiny. I mean, you can barely, you know, put your hands over your head to wash your hair. But they're fun.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, you're a little more athletic than I am. We're going to take calls in a second, I promise you, at 877-301-8970. I'm not as strong as you are. Do you find it hard holding yourself up, suspending yourself from the ceiling when the toilets overflow? I mean, how long can you hold?
Well, that is of course, an issue. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine how carnival's going to
stay.
No food. You know what they did to these people?
Toilets overflowing through every single aisle on every level.
And did you read what they gave these people after this ordeal? They gave them a discount, and their next trip is half price. Half price. They should be giving them a full refund and give them a free trip.
Well, you left out
forward.
One thing. They also gave them all free toilet seats. I don't know if you're Brendan, you're in Oxford, Massachusetts. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Briefly, if you would, with Jim and Marty. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, how you doing?
You're a carnival guy or what?
Yeah, well, I'm getting married this summer, and I'm looking for a cruise, and I was thinking about going on Carnival, because you figure they have to be cheaper. Like, by this summer, they'll probably be so cheap by this summer, right? And what's the chances of it happening again this summer?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well,
right, it happened too.
That's
are you
the
serious?
Guy just said.
Are you really thinking of going on your honeymoon on this, or are you kidding?
Huh?
Are you really thinking of going on your honeymoon on Carnival, Brendan?
Yes, absolutely.
Hope springs eternal.
Just save some money, man.
Brendan, you have exactly the right attitude. Happy wedding and happy marriage. Let's go to Alan in Boston. Would you ever do a Carnival cruise, Alan?
Well, I certainly wouldn't right now. But one thing you should know is that the Costa Cruise Lines of Costa Concordia, which is sitting on its site in Italy right now,
still, yeah,
that is a Carnival property.
It
Carnival owns Costa.
I did not know that.
I was not aware of that.
I did not know that. But that was where the captain famously abandoned ship.
He
and
did.
They had the guy from the
No. He fell off the bridge into a lake.
That's what
that's
he said.
Right.
That was one of the great stories.
You're correct. He fell off the bridge.
Alan, can we get your opinion since you seem to... What is your opinion of the prior caller who was contemplating taking his honeymoon on a Carnival cruise? Thank you.
Variety forbids.
Alan, thank you for the call. Let's take one more quick one. Drew, you're in Newport, Rhode Island with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Drew.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Fine,
thanks for the call.
I've just been listening to your show while I'm in the car, and the thought of going on a cruise with 3,000 or 4,000 other people is just revolting to me.
By the way, you said it better than I. And by the way, even if there had been no Carnival problems, those are my words. 3,000 or 4,000 people who you don't know, like in prison together.
Well, also, we haven't mentioned the norovirus. Remember the norovirus, whatever it was, that all these people were getting sick to their stomach on these boats. That always makes for a pleasant cruise down to St. Martin, don't you think?
Drew, I think you put the exclamation point on. Drew, thank you so much for the call. I'm sorry we don't have more time for this because it's one of my obsessions. And I want to be fair for a second. There are thousands of people who love cruises, who swear by them, who would do them again. I happen not to be one
of them. Okay, Jim. Up next, it's time for our Friday News Quiz with singer-songwriter Will Daly and Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Stay tuned, for that. It's going to be lots of fun. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. This is our Friday News Quiz. This week's contestants are Sue O'Connell, who is the editor of the South End News and Bay Windows and is not marching in the South Boston.
I am not.
St. Patrick's Day Parade. She'll tell you why in a couple of minutes. And one of my favorite recording artists, Will Daly, is a Boston guy. He won the Boston Music Award in 2006, 2009, 2012 for Best Male Singer-Songwriter, and he's got a great new project he's going to talk about. How are you, Will?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here.
Great to see you. What is Pledge Music? I love this idea. I know it's not your idea only.
Right.
What's this deal you just got involved in?
Well, I was in a horrible record label situation, 2011, 2012, major label situation. Fought to get myself out. And pledge music is essentially you get the funds to make your record by basically pre-selling it to your fans, along with all kinds of exclusive ideas and material, house concerts. You know, some people offer all kinds of crazy things. I didn't do anything too crazy.
You got 100, you hit 100%.
We reached 100% of our goal, and we're still climbing and still
shooting. So when's the new record going to be
out? Well, I started recording it before we hit 100%, so I'm about 50% done, and now I kind of breathe a sigh of relief and go record the rest of it.
I want you to know, I pledged $250, for which I get Will Daly to record a cover of any single song I want. How great is that?
What's it going to be?
What's
it going to be?
What's
the song going to be, Jim? It's going to be,
what is it?
I know what it's going to be.
Thunder
No,
Road.
It's not going to be Thunder Road. I'm going to sink out. What are you laughing about, Will? I mean, what if it was
so
Thunder Road?
It's so original.
It is. Just
their harmony on the answer was amazing.
What do you think it should be, Sue O'Connell, who I'm told has been on a cruise and you should be ashamed of yourself?
I love cruises.
Okay, fine.
I love cruises.
Carnival, I've got a ticket for you for your birthday.
Listen, I've been in a resort community where the toilets all backed up and went down the main street in a Cape Cod.
How was that? Good?
So. You know, YMCA you should do as your new
theme
song.
It will be the best cover of YMCA you ever got.
Yeah.
I hear you do
or
great
in the
at
Navy.
YMCA. Okay, so in any case, should we start our quiz?
Yes, we're going to start.
And you're going to play a little bit for us
I
at
am.
Some point, right?
I have been locked in a studio for a couple of days, so I don't know what's going on in the world, so it's going to be pretty funny.
Okay. You know,
answers.
I love
That's
these
okay.
I hate, no, I hate that,
Here
too,
we go.
When
you
people
know.
Say in advance. That's the Okay, let's
okay,
guess.
Okay, you ready, Will
You
Daly?
Can ask Will a question.
Here we go. Here's Jimmy Fallon, Craig Ferguson, and Conan O'Brien reacting to someone who got a major job promotion this week.
You could tell he was South American because when they announced it, they were like, "We have a poll!"
Congratulations, new Pope. Now, we must all remember that the last Pope, Pope Benedict, will now be known as Pope Classic.
We have a new Pope. The Vatican has chosen the first ever Argentinian Pope. So once again, a bunch of old white guys got a Hispanic to do a job they didn't want to do.
Okay, Will Daly, the question is, what is the Pope's name and what was it before he was named to the position?
Oh, my God. It's Francis.
That
very
is very good.
Good. Okay,
so you're halfway
part one
there.
Is correct.
And so part one. And then before, I think it's Eddie.
That is close. Now, Sue, if you know the answer, you can steal the second half of the question.
His name was Bishop Enrique Iglesias.
This is really horrible.
No, that is not correct either.
What is the answer, Margaret?
The answer is Jorge Mario Bergoglio.
Jorge
to you, by the way.
Jorge.
All I could think was the Berlusconi. I knew that wasn't it.
No, he is not. And he didn't get to vote.
He's the exact opposite of Berlusconi.
Even though he's under 80. Yeah. Yes, he is. He exactly is. Okay, Sue O'Connell, who is crackerjack at these kinds of games. You ready?
It's true. Ready, go.
Yesterday, a prominent voice from the past emerged blaming a favorite whipping boy, the media, of course, for his and his like-minded brothers and sisters for their woes. Who is speaking and where is he speaking?
Now, the popular media narrative is that this country has shifted away from conservative ideals, as evidenced by the last two presidential elections. That's what they think. That's what they say. That might be true if Republicans had actually nominated conservative candidates in 2008 and 2012. Might be true.
So here's the question again. Who is the speaker and where is he speaking, Sue O'Connell?
He's speaking at CPAC, and the speaker is Rush Limbaugh.
That is half right.
Half
it is
right.
The conservative political. Actually, and Will Daly is totally embarrassing himself
by
thrusting his arm. Who
he's
is
all
it?
Enthusiastic.
Rick Perry.
That is exactly
that is
right.
Right. That is very good.
You're smart.
I would recognize that voice anywhere. He's hilarious.
Can I do my favorite imitation?
Certainly. Go ahead.
His wife, I think it was Anita Perry, was responding to the 999 plan that was voiced by Herman Cain. And her great line, it was one of the best lines of the campaign. She said, "Every time I hear 999, I want to call 911. I love it. In any case, so do you think that Rick Perry is suggesting that maybe the Republicans haven't learned the lessons of the last couple? He's basically saying they weren't conservative enough.
Listen, the whole CPAC thing is exploding with the gay conservatives who are basically calling out CPAC and Republicans as bigots. You know, that there's this motion to move forward.
Great.
You know, that, listen, we can be Republican. We can be gay, we can be black, we can be Hispanic, but we can't be bigots. And if we're going to move forward, this is what we have to do. I think it's an exciting time
Did you
for
hear, Senator Rand Paul, who, of course, is famous now for his 13-hour filibuster, suggesting earlier this week that government just get out of marriage completely.
Well, that's, you know,
that's a real libertarian position.
It's a libertarian
position,
that no one should, you know, there's a reason why pastors can sign marriage licenses. It's because, you know, when we headed out west, sometimes the only government official, if you will, out there was a pastor who would marry people. Let everybody have civil unions. Let everybody enter into contracts if they want.
Yeah.
If you want to get married in your church or your temple, knock yourself out.
I thought it was a brilliant idea.
Still single, Sue O'Connell. Still single.
What are you saying, Will?
It's hard to tell when someone says something like that, what Rick Perry said, if he means what brand of conservative it means. Does he mean conservatism that treasures our national parks and the lives of our soldiers and their well-being after war, or that kind of conservatism? We conserve what it means to take care of what we're given and take responsibility for it, or the conservatism that has had many different definitions in the past 10, 12 years.
I don't think he means the good one.
Well, and also, what it also means is it doesn't include people like Chris Christie, that he wasn't invited, the governor of Virginia. I mean, in terms of the big tent kind of thing, it's a relatively small tent. Let's try to squeeze in another question before the break, and then Will Daly is going to play for us. Will Daly, a well-known Massachusetts native, playfully announced he's joining a Boston sports team. The question is, who is this person, and why did he hold a press conference earlier this week?
Did you know also that I'm going to let you in on a real secret. I am actually signing a 10-day contract with the Boston Celtics, too. Did you know that? Yeah. Doc called me the other day, and I'm going to be signing a 10-day contract. There is an opening. You know, Rondo's down, and so.
Here's the question again. Who is the person? Why did he hold a press conference earlier this week? And your bonus question, to which I actually knew the answer without looking it up, what was this person's nickname in college? Go ahead, Will Daly.
That's Scott Brown.
That is exactly right. Thank you for the little bell.
What's the next?
The next question is, why was he holding a press conference?
Can I do the bonus first?
Yeah, you can. You don't know the answer. You don't know
his nickname was Centerfold. And he is having the press conference because he's not running for Senate.
No.
Well,
okay,
so
he got a job.
He got
at Nixon. At Nixon.
Peabody law firm.
Peabody.
Do you know his college nickname?
Scotto.
No, that's close. His nickname was Downtown Scotty Brown.
Wow.
When he played basketball at Tufts, and this actually isn't part of the question. What is the mascot for Tufts? This is great.
Oh, it's the elephant.
It's the Jumbos.
Oh, Jumbo the elephant.
That?
Jumbo the elephant.
It is.
Yeah,
yes.
I knew you'd have that reaction, but that's
Jumbo
totally
the elephant.
True. It's Jumbo. You said that already.
You know where I learned that? I learned that on your prior show,
Marjorie. You did?
You should have been paying attention.
God, I forgot that.
Exactly.
Memory like a sieve.
She wasn't really there
ear.
That day. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, Sue is going to tell us what's wrong with the parade on Sunday.
I got lots to
and
say.
Will Daly is going to tell us and sing to us what's right with his new CD coming out very, very soon. We shall return.
Decades of advocacy have done little to change the stark racial disparities in the nation's prisons. But a new study shows it's happening anyway, a dramatic drop in the number of African Americans locked up in the last decade. We take a look at the latest numbers and what's behind them next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Private Bank, committed to providing a personalized approach to banking and investing. Boston Private Bank. This is your time. This is your private bank. More information available at bostonprivatebank.com. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health.
Here he is, Will Daly, on Boston Public Radio.
I'm jumping overboard, Cap, and swimming back to shore, 'cause now I know you're bailing with a thimble for a bucket-sized hole, covered in a treasure no one wants. I don't want. captain of a sunken ship, sunken in the shallow water. You're standing out on the bridge still thinking, oh, captain of a sunken ship, sunken in the shallow water. You're standing out on the bridge still thinking, you're still sailing.
Will Daly. You're willdaly.com, are you not?
Yeah,
is that D-A-I-L-E-Y. Not right?
D-A-I-L-E-Y.
That was great.
Whoa. So before you get to the next question, what's up with the parade on Sunday? More of the same?
More of the same. St. Patrick's Day traditional parade, which has not allowed gay and lesbian groups to march, has rejected the application from Mass Equality, which is the gay and lesbian sort of political action group, based on referencing the Hurley decision from 1992, which said they could exclude.
Where the Supreme Court said they could exclude, right.
But because it was full. So I guess that's some sort of progress that they're rejecting us because there's no room, not just because
we're
gay.
So does that mean if you apply early for next year, then theoretically
you should
get in?
We'll work on that. I mean, every year we're taking steps closer, and I know that, you know, some unlikely folks behind the scenes have been really working with the out-of-town person who runs the South Boston Day Parade, who doesn't even live in Southie. And I know that Maureen Dayhill and Linda Dorsey-Afori have really been the women leading the way, sort of like in the old IRA, where the mothers are the ones who said, listen, we have to knock this off.
Those are two of the candidates who are running for the state Senate seat that Jack Harper
and Maureen is from Southie. She's a Southie
girl.
She has a great blog. Caught in Southie or whatever.
It is somehow ridiculous in 2013.
And it's ridiculous
in Boston,
to care about
in
it.
In Massachusetts.
You know, I don't want to care about this. Yeah. I don't care. I don't like parades. You don't like cruises. I don't like parades. I don't want to go to the parade.
It's just discrimination.
I don't want to have to show up. I hate it. I was at the men's event for the Fenway Community Health Center last week, and an African-American fellow who works in government looked at me and said, what's the big deal? I said, well, what if they didn't allow blacks to march? Oh, that would be different. Oh, okay. So, you know, it's, again, gays and women at the bottom of the barrel, right?
And you can read about it all in the Great Bay Windows. You're the co-publisher
and still publishing.
Still publishing, right, after our Phoenix discussion.
The heroes, woo! Yeah.
Okay, here's your question to try. I think you're going to try to tie it up or something. What celebrated Bostonian, Sue O'Connell, packed his bags this week and headed west? Don't answer till you hear the sound. Here's a hint, a famous clip that reveals a particular fetish that this guy had.
He does a great job of making sure everybody's on the same page and everybody's putting their best foot forward. You can't just stick your toe in the water, especially, you know, you got your foot up in the air. You want to go out there and just put your best foot forward. He's got great feet. You know, he has good feet. He's another guy.
It's enough good foot talk, I think. So the question for
really
you,
excited.
Sue, is Dame, please keep that to yourself. Name the player in the team he is headed to Sue O'Connell.
Welker Welkin, and he's heading to the Colts.
That both of those would be wrong. Oh. Now, Will Daly, what is the name? It's close. Yeah. What's the name of the player? What's the name
my
of the
My first
team?
Guess was Rex Ryan, but I'm going to
Rex
say,
Ryan is the guy he
the
was talking
fetish.
About.
Yeah, that's a different,
give him a half a point for that, please.
And
the
then also,
fetish.
That's Wes Welker going to the Broncos.
That too. Is exactly right.
Oh, what? I got half of it.
You know, understated he did that kind of thing.
I know, he's very good. He's.
I thought it was so refreshing that Rex Ryan was enjoying his foot fetish with his actual wife. I thought that was
I did. You know, I thought that too.
There was. There's an actual video.
Because I watched that video every Friday night, and I'm thankful every time that it's his wife and not some little,
exactly.
You know.
I love that, too. Yeah. Okay, Will, here's your question.
Oh, actually, you're leading. I was just told by our producers you were leading by a crushing 4.5-2. Congratulations.
Me.
Go ahead.
What is David Bowie singing about here, and why is it significant this week? Okay, what's he saying about, and why is it significant this week?
This is a career ender. If you don't get
this, you look a little worried.
It's about drugs, but if you ask me specifically, but he has an album out.
No, that was not the answer.
What? His album did come out this week.
Well, maybe it did, but that wasn't what he was saying.
It's his 30th anniversary, isn't it?
This
is a hard one. This is
a hard
one. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's about his song is Life on Mars, and the Mars was bleeped out because the New York Times reported this week that life could have existed on Mars.
Oh, this is such a public radio question. I'll tell you.
This isn't a music question.
I gave you.
Sorry.
I was about to talk about track 7 on his new album.
Can I get back to you for a second before I decide what song I want you to cover for my $250 pledge? Are a lot of people in your... I love this idea when I read it. I mean, it gives you independence. You can do whatever the hell you want, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people doing this? Or
it is. A lot of people are doing this. Mm-hmm. The Lumineers, they did pledge music.
Really?
Ben Folds just did pledge music. B.B. King. So a lot of people are doing it. The difference between pledge music and Kickstarter. Kickstarter can be anything. Pledge music is just music. And it's run by musicians.
And we're looking for a model for the paper, honestly, for the paper.
That's what we talked about.
Yeah, because, I mean, honestly, advertising, as has been tragically pointed out this week by
as
the Phoenix,
Peter Kadzis told us at 12 o'clock today,
is not the way to print papers or print news anymore. So what if I asked you to, you know, give us $250 at Bay Windows
to cover a song.
Again, I'll have to do more covers.
Andrew Sullivan, the blogger, the great blogger, has done it quite successfully, and he's able to earn a living now blogging because of his subscribers' contributions.
But you basically put all your eggs in this basket. I read what you wrote about it on the Pledge Music. Were you worried that as much as your fans, I'm one of them, loves you, what if it didn't happen? I mean, it's sort of the end of the game, right?
It was stressful as it's climbing, but it's also really exciting because when you're recording records, you're kind of in a vacuum. You're in the studio. The doors are closed. You're in there with your friends. But you're liking what you're doing, but you don't know what the world's really going to think about it. While we're doing this, you see this report at the end of the day, all the names that did it. And the names are on your mind, and you're kind of, you feel less alone, you feel less vulnerable,
that's great.
You feel braver, you feel more secure, and you feel more connected. And there's a whole community behind your music before you even put it out. So it's wonderful.
I was noticing that you looked thinner this time than last time I saw you, and I thought maybe that you had
lost
really...
147 pounds since I saw you.
And I gained it, by the way. That's the voice of the great Will Daly, and he has a new CD coming out soon, thanks to his work on Pledge Music. And Sue O'Connell is publisher of Bay Windows in the South End News. Sue, here's a question.
Oh, okay.
This is Stephen Colbert talking a year ago about Doritos.
A crunchy Dorito shell can increase the sales appeal of anything. Yes, Europe is in financial freefall, but the solution's obvious. Goodbye, Euro. Hello, Eurito. And Detroit always needs a boost. So on every new car, replace crumple zones with crunch zones. If you get into an accident, you can just eat your way to safety. You are your own jaws of life. And folks, I am not surprised these tacos are popular. I am a longtime fan of Doritos.
Okay, here's a question, Sue O'Connell. You get one point if you can give the brand name of what Stephen Colbert was talking about, and you get another point if you can tell us why this thing, this brand, is in the news this week.
Oh, boy, these are really hard questions.
Very hard.
This is public radio here.
I'll tell you. Doritos, I have no idea. I think that they're putting ice cream in Doritos.
That may be true, but that is not the answer to the question. Now, Will Daly, with an I, by the way, do you know that? Is that an I in it, Daly?
It has an A, an I, and an E.
It does all those things. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Will Daly, what's the question? What's the brand name, what he's talking about? And you get another point if you can tell us why it's in the news this week. This is a great story, actually.
Well, Doritos, they had that Taco Bell Dorito, but also they discovered that the leftover residue is not important to the flavor.
And the orange never washes off your hands. Is that what you're trying
to say?
That's a great
guess. That is true. I
have an answer. Life on Mars.
that was the prior question. Thank you. Here's the answer, and this is a great story.
They're not allowed to march Doritos in the parade.
Maybe they can. Doritos Locos Tacos is the name of the thing. But this is as horrible as the food is for you. Taco Bell reportedly added, according to them, 15,000 employees this week to handle the growth of the company after the launch of this thing, Doritos Locos Tacos. They sold 1 million of these a day last year.
With a shell.
That's why we're the second fattest nation on the planet.
Doritos.
It is made of Doritos.
It's made out of Doritos. And they're going to do another one now with Cool Ranch Doritos.
Ooh.
I mean, really healthy.
Okay, cool.
And what's the problem? Why are you all looking upset?
The
about
next
it?
Question is for Will Dale. This is a great one, actually.
Okay, well,
go ahead, Marguerite.
This is a hard one too.
It's great though,
because I didn't even heard of this until I got the news quiz.
Can you identify the creature making these sounds, Will, and why they were in the news this week?
Excellent sound.
Okay. They're sea creatures making that sound. You can't mm-hmm. identify the ocean there. Do you have any idea what creatures those were and why they were squealing with glee or distress?
Seals or, dolphins.
Dolphins!
Give them
that's it!
Yeah.
Dolphins!
Why are they in
that's
the news?
Great! They were doing something terrible.
Yeah.
They were.
Exactly.
Yeah, they were. I wouldn't call it terrible. They were. Were they mating?
No.
They were attacking.
They were attacking.
The Suocala, the killer dolphins. Yeah, they were.
They were attacking. They were killing the seals.
Dolphins. That was like a half a bell you got.
No.
I thought this was horrible.
What was it?
Apparently, we in other countries train these killer dolphins to go after divers that may be plotting to put a bomb and explosive on a boat.
Yeah, we have military dolphins.
We have military dolphins.
You didn't know
dolphins.
That? We have military dolphins.
I did not know. Yes. We have Sergeant Dolphin running around out there in the...
Which I think is a bad idea because they'll be coming after us.
Okay, enough of that.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's what I'm worried about.
How many points...
Aren't you worried about that?
No. How many points, judges, is Sue O'Connell behind, roughly? Make it up if you don't know. Three behind. This question is worth 3 points, Sue O'Connell.
Of course. Good.
Sorry,
I don't know
Will.
What this is about what? Either.
I've been
busy. I usually win these things. I've been very busy.
Are we just playing sound?
Very busy.
Is that
what
we're doing?
I told you.
Some, listen to the sound, then I'll ask you the question. Here it is.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important.
Okay, that song obviously is Particle Man. Is pretty obvious by They Might Be Giants. Here's a question. What particle, you have to pronounce it properly too. Did scientists all but confirm this week by way of the Large Hadron, I hope that's what it's called, Hadron Collider. What is it? It has two names. You get 2 points.
The Bossum particle.
Well, the God particle's right. You don't get... Now, Will, you can win everything if you can name this formally. Will Daly, take it away.
I'm going to say my nickname for it is the Higgs Boston, but it's the Higgs Boston.
Yes!
Yeah, okay.
I call it the Boston. Okay. See, you have to have a nickname for
it. Now, here's the big bonus. Mm-hmm. You know, can someone... I know it's supposed to be this, like, molasses-like stuff that gives us mass and resistance. Mm-hmm. I don't really get this at all.
Well, it was in Spider-Man 2.
You have to watch Spider-Man 2.
Is it really?
The other thing, Marjorie, is that life is all projection. There actually is no life, and since they can't prove that this isn't a video game, it doesn't mean that it is. And so, therefore, who cares?
She's talking about the Matrix.
Okay, I thought this was supposed to be some big thing.
It is a big thing.
It's
huge.
Can't
who knows?
What have we broken through? That's my question. Do you know, Jim?
I just know that somebody is going to win a Nobel Prize for this.
Okay.
It's the thing on which all matter is... matters.
Because everything has matter.
Small
everything,
small.
Even
everything matters.
It's the molasses that gives us the matter.
Fluid.
Exactly.
You know, air is fluid.
Right.
You know, that's how planes can fly, because they're not flying on nothing. They're flying on fluid.
This is supposed to be a molasses bath.
Okay.
Well, I don't feel like
science correspondent will be calling in 3 minutes.
Right.
Unfortunately, we'll be gone at that
People
particular time.
People have driven
time.
Off the road.
Now, here's the deal. Yes. Will Daly, with an I, is going to play us out of this particular show. I'm first going to tell you what you've been listening to Boston Public Radio. I want to thank Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows in the South End News.
Still
publishing. Thank Will Daly. So the deal is I communicate with you, tell you what song I want to cover, and you do it?
Yep.
And you send me it?
Yep, and you're the owner of it, yeah.
That is unbelievable. Yeah. This is really exciting.
And there's all kinds of exclusives still up. And you're going to like this. Everything that we raise past 100% of our goal, 10% is going to go to Farm Aid.
Oh, that's fabulous. Yes. Which is where I met you many years ago. It was a great day. And Farm Aid, wonderful organization. So you can still go to pledgemusic.com if you want to contribute there.
Yep. Or willdaly.com.
It's great. By the way, on Monday, Emily Rooney is going to be sitting in for Marjorie. She's off for a couple of days. We're going to talk about serial killer TV and the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court case, which guaranteed people a right to counsel in criminal proceedings. But before we do, here he is, Will Daly.
You crawled into my life. Rags and desperation. All you needed was a line. But I wasn't much the better of myself. Yeah, I was as lost somehow you knew I'd be just what you need.